Welcome, welcome, welcome to this week's edition of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Not recorded live at the TuneIn studio in Venice, California, but at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California, back in May. My guest this week is Steve Boom, who's head of Amazon Music. The fact that you may not be familiar with his name, you're certainly familiar with Amazon Music. You should check this out because it's a stealth operation and it's got a lot of customers. You should know what's going on. So without further ado, Steve Boom at the Music Media Summit. Last time I got together with Steve, he was so formal that I thought that was his image. Now he's so relaxed, I have to reevaluate my perception. Anyway, we were at lunch, and a friend of ours who works for Concord Music, which now owns Razor and Tie, said that the number one streamed music on your service is Kidz Bop. Is that correct?
No.
Because I said it was Garth Brooks.
Kidz Bop's pretty up there.
Okay.
So's Garth. I think our service, the number one artist I'd have to check, but most recently was Bruno Mars. But
okay.
Kidz Bop is up there. We have a lot of people, you know, when you have an inexpensive device, a lot of people have put Echo Dots in their kids' rooms, and family has always been a really important part of the Amazon customer base. So I think we make up. The converse of that, though, is true. I'm sure that we're the number one streamer for Kidz Bop. If I looked across the different streaming services, I think that would be a runaway.
Well, if you look at Spotify, where everything's totally, you can see, the Spotify Top 50, very dominated by urban music.
Yep.
Okay? And Apple does not stop trumpeting how they're breaking records with their urban streams. Rumor has it that the complexion of music on Amazon that people are listening to is different. Is that correct?
That's not a rumor. That's fact. Absolutely. If you were just look at our charts, you would see a much greater diverse profile of listening. Urban is important to our streaming service, like every other streaming service. That's kind of strange. I have to kind of crane my neck here a little. But you'd see a much greater blend. You'd see a lot of country songs. You'd see rock. You'd see pop. If you go down past the top 50, you might even see a classical track or two up there.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, it is very different. I think when we see who our customers are, you know, we compare that to the charts and the other services, we feel pretty confident in saying that, you know, we're reaching new segments of the streaming addressable market and bringing those people into paid streaming.
And a lot of people don't know a lot about Amazon Music. So if you have Amazon Prime,
yeah,
what can you listen to?
If you have Amazon Prime, you get a catalog of about 2 million songs that we've
chosen.
But
you get two of the three major companies, correct?
All three majors.
You get all three majors now. When did the third major come on board?
Oh, gosh, 2.5, 3 years ago. Yeah, quite a while ago. You get all three majors, most indies. But it's a limited catalog. So, you know, we launched Prime Music in 2014. And the whole premise back then was, you have to remember, dial back, right? Spotify was much, much smaller.
Right.
Apple Music didn't exist. There was a bunch of startups who were offering $10 a month. And we knew we needed to be in streaming, but we also knew from our own music store that back in 2013, 2014, very, very few people were actually spending anything close to $120 a year, which is what $10 a month adds up to. In fact, the bottom 80% of our customers were spending about $15 a year. Right. So our idea behind Prime Music was let's give these people a lot of music. They're more casual music listeners. But let's take out all that friction when we talk to people. What do you not like about the free music services? I don't like the ads. I don't like the fact that I can't take it offline. I don't like the fact that I can have limited skips and all that stuff. So the idea behind Prime Music was, let's make a music service for everybody else. Because at the time, the only people who were interested in $10 a month, the market has totally moved since then. But back then, it was a small sliver of people who wanted $10 a month, probably everyone in this room. But you guys aren't representative of the average consumer. And, you know, out of the gate, the whole industry misunderstood it. But consumers didn't, because it was adopted really, really quickly. And there's a lot of curation involved. You know, we have a team.
Okay, so that was 2014.
Yeah.
How would you see the market today?
There's definitely been, so that whole segment still exists and is still growing rapidly. You always got to remember that 50% of the U.S. population or any other population historically hasn't spent anything on music, let alone $10 a month. There's always been terrestrial radio. There's always been almost always been cable music choice and YouTube and all these other alternatives. So that's still growing. But what seems to have happened in the last 3 years is a shift in mentality among consumers. I don't know if there's just greater awareness of what a great value $10 a month really is for all that music. I think Netflix and Hulu and all these other services have helped. Right, people are used to subscribing to things and not thinking of it as I'm paying for music, but I'm paying for entertainment. I think devices like the Echo lower the barrier because it's something you use so frequently and it's frictionless. And so we see the projections that existed in 2013, 2014 for the size of the $10 a month market, those are wrong now. I mean, it's clear that the market's grown more quickly than anyone anticipated.
And if the percentage is on your service, you have baked into Amazon Prime, so you're not being charged per month.
Correct.
You have a $3.99 to listen on an Echo. You have essentially a $10 program to listen a la Spotify, Apple Music. Mm-hmm. How do the subscribers or the listeners break down amongst those three choices?
Yeah, I mean, so the $3.99 is really the same. We have two services, Prime Music and Amazon Music Unlimited. Prime is a limited catalog. Unlimited, as the name might suggest, a full catalog service. But one of the innovations that we had was at launch is say, we think the Echo is incomplete without a full catalog of music service. If you've ever used one, you've got an intelligent assistant. You want to ask her anything, and the analogy I always give people is imagine if you said, hey, Alexa, what's the weather in Santa Barbara? And she'd say, well, I'm sorry, the weather in Santa Barbara is not included with your Prime membership. I only have the weather in San Francisco and Seattle. Not a great experience. And so we've always felt that for that device where it has no screen, where you can ask her anything, she's intelligent and always getting more intelligent, and you expect her to be able to give you what you want, that it demands a full catalog. And we took the approach of saying, went to the labels and said, we think there's a real opportunity here to, for the first time, have what a lot of people call a mid-tier service, but not a dumbed-down service. It's a full catalog, has all the features and functionality. The one limitation is that you're restricted to that single device. But it is Amazon Music Unlimited. There's absolutely nothing different about it except that you can only play it on that one Echo. That's been really successful for us, and we've seen a pretty significant percentage of people who come on to that on-ramp leave and go to the full-price plan, whether an individual plan because they want to listen on their phone or a family plan because they might have multiple Echoes and they liked having concurrent streams. So Prime Music's been around, to answer your question more directly, Prime Music's been around for 4 years, next month, in June. Amazon Music Unlimited has been around for 18 months. It's not quite 50-50, but it's getting close. And so Amazon Music Unlimited is growing really, really fast. And Prime Music continues to grow faster than Prime, so we're pretty happy there too.
Okay, let's go back. You don't come from the music business.
No, although the last 6.5 years I do.
Yeah. Okay, so we always like to get where someone's coming from. We've discussed this before, but for the people who are not here, you grow up?
A lot of places. I was born in New Jersey, grew up overseas and in New Jersey until I was 12, and then moved to Houston, Texas. My parents are immigrants from Belgium, and so I spent a lot of time in Europe. Growing up, and then came out to California for college, and my adult life have lived a bunch more places, so a bit all over.
But after college, you went to law school.
Yep, I did.
And when you went to law school, what was your intention relative to practicing?
So my original plan, because I was an engineering guy, I was an electrical engineer in college, as well as a history major. And, the life plan was, go work as an engineer for a few years, go get an MBA and do that. And I did work as an engineer for Compaq Computer, if anybody remembers that brand. Yeah, there's enough people my age in here.
I certainly remember it was.
I mean, I just was addressing Amazon's got a small office in Santa Barbara, and I was going to talk to the people there before coming here, and I was like, I think I'm 20 years older than every single person in this room. But I realized I didn't really enjoy being an engineer, so I decided to go to law school. So the plan was always go practice for a few years, but just take a different path to the same end point, which is to get into the business world in one way or another.
And what kind of law did you practice?
Corporate law, starting in Washington, D.C., and that was miserable. And then moved back out to Northern California and met at my five-year college reunion a partner in a very small tech law firm. And by the end of lunch, I was ready to come out and started there 1996, the day that Yahoo went public. And it was, and this company, this law firm represented Yahoo. So it was a very exciting day. At that law firm is one of the, you know, that was the beginning of the internet. Netscape had gone public 6 months or a year prior, and it was just a crazy, crazy time. So I worked with startups for about 2.5-3 years.
And what did you actually do as the lawyer?
A variety of things. So, you know, you do finance work, work with the venture capitalists to raise money, take companies public, do mergers. But the fun stuff that we did was actually, we really kind of acted as their outsourced general counsel, you know, because these are small companies. They may have money in the bank from Sequoia or one of these big VCs. But so when it came to doing partnerships, commercial partnerships with people, we would get involved at a much earlier stage than you would normally associate with a legal team. Normally it's like, hey, we've negotiated a deal, paper it. That's not how we worked. We were in there, a lot of the guys, and this was the early days of the internet, a lot of the guys that were the biz dev guys, the business development guys at these companies, they didn't know crap. They didn't know anything about the internet. No one did. But we actually knew more just because, you know, we would represent 10 companies. You would see 10 things. All these people were straight out of business school and they were just in their little lane with their one company. So we got involved very early and hand in hand. It was a lot of fun.
So you enjoyed that as opposed to working in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, I enjoyed it until I realized the learning curve started to flatten out, you know, and I think in any job, you probably look up and say at the people you work for, do I want to be that person? And as people, I would have been happy to be them. They're really nice guys, but I didn't want to be in their job. I didn't want to be a partner at that firm. So
how'd you segue into your next role?
I reached out to some clients and...
So you were actively looking to get out.
Yeah, I had one of those moments. I still remember it. I was at a wedding of a friend of mine back east and was flying back with my now wife. And we were sitting watching a movie and I wasn't watching the movie. My brain was just going a mile a minute. And I remember just blurting out, I'm done. And she looked at me, she goes, what'd you say? I said, I'll tell you later. Watch the movie. I just had one of those moments where you're like, I don't want to do this anymore. And so I started reaching out to clients.
Now, at the time, was your soon-to-be wife, was she working?
Yeah, yeah.
So was there any issue of economic instability? Or you say, I'm not leaving the law until I find another thing?
Yeah, I didn't leave until I found a job. That was a lesson my father taught me. He's like, got more leverage if you're still working. So,
okay, so you reach out to your clients. What do you find?
A lot of interest. And I, you know, I talked to both startups and then I talked to Yahoo. And Yahoo at that time was a newly public startup, basically. You know, it's hard. A lot of people here are old enough to remember, but it was the hottest company in the world, bar none. They were looking for someone at the time. They're starting to expand in Europe, and Europe generally was a couple years behind the U.S. from an internet, except in Scandinavia, but in Maine, you know, the Big Five was kind of behind the U.S. And so they've been looking, they couldn't find anyone, and they're looking for someone to run business development. And I have a European background, and so that helped. And they said, do you want to give it a shot? I'm like, if you'll give a shot on me, I'll take it. And so we moved to London.
And so if you're moving in London, you're, you know, 8 time zones away. So yeah. One would think you're pretty much running your own show.
Yeah, you get a lot of autonomy. You know, you spend a lot of time back in California. The company of that age and doing business development means like doing partnerships. That doesn't mean selling advertising. It means like product type integrations, right? And which means you need engineering support, which happens in California. So you spend a lot of time on just say you get a lot of phone calls when you're ready to go to bed from people.
Right. And London. Then your brain is firing and you can't go to bed.
Yeah, exactly. So we loved it. It was a great 4 years in London. It was fantastic.
And ultimately a success or a frustration in terms of executing on your role?
Oh, it was great. No, there were frustrations, but I haven't had a job that doesn't have frustrations. So, but the net output was great. It was great.
And when you were done, 4 years later, are Yang and his original partner still in charge?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Jerry was there when I left the company. He had just become CEO. We were at our second CEO in LF. So Tim Kugel was the original CEO of Yahoo, and then Terry Semel had joined while I was based in London.
Okay, so how do you decide we're at the end of Yahoo?
Well, first they brought me back, got promoted, did a bunch of other things. I spent a total of 10 years there. The first four were in London.
Okay, then maybe I misunderstood or forgot. So the next 6 years when you're back in the Valley, what is your role?
It evolved to be head of mobile, effectively. So I was the SVP of mobile. To date myself, this was mostly in the feature phone era. We did a lot of J2ME apps. We used WAP browsers. It's like getting flashbacks. I left Yahoo 2 months after the App Store launched. Okay, so we were there on, Jerry was on stage with Steve when the iPhone launched. Yahoo was a big part of that launch. Yahoo Mail was embedded in the service, and the stocks and weather apps, though they were called widgets back then by Apple, were all powered by Yahoo. So that's when we knew the world had changed. Like the first day when iPhones actually hit the market in June of 2007, you may or may not remember this, but they went on sale at 6 p.m., but 6 p.m. in each time zone. So we sat in California. They were on sale in New York on the East Coast, and we just sat with the engineers and just watched the data of people using it, and it blew us away because, you know, you were like, for years, the perennial question that someone would ask you is probably similar to what was going on with streaming. Like, you could take this story and apply it to streaming. But every year, you know, you'd have your business plan review and Jerry Yang or Terry Semel was like, when is mobile actually finally going to be big? And you're like, it's 2 years away. Every year, it's 2 years
away. Well, the analogy I always use is digital photography. We heard for 10 years that digital photography is going to come in and kill Kodak.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, 1 year it happened, everybody
and
got
all
a
of a sudden
digital
it
camera.
Did.
And it's like, wow.
And when iPhone happened, we'd seen BlackBerries were the most used devices for mobile internet then, but they were really horrible for mobile internet. You know, they just weren't designed for it. But most people had them, their companies were paying for their data, so you'd use it anyway. And then iPhone came in, and despite there being, you know, how many few devices actually went online that day, it was like these spikes. And we all sat around, it was like, the world's changed. It's changed forever. And that, by the way, it's what changed for music as well. I mean, the iPhone, smartphones are really the foundation of the streaming evolution over the last 10 years.
Okay, so, looking at Yahoo, which has now been sold, was it savable? And if it was savable, what should they have done differently?
Was it savable? I don't think it was by the time it got to that point. I think Yahoo suffered, and one of the things that attracted me about coming to Amazon, it never had the kind of visionary CEO. Jerry's an amazing guy. First of all, he was never the CEO. He never wanted to be. And he was only when he was forced to be because there was no one else who wanted the job. He's an amazing guy and had a really good vision, but he wasn't the CEO that could just galvanize the whole company behind it. And Yahoo got stuck. Are we a media company or are we a technology company? And it was never, never land. Had it decided that years before, perhaps savable, but I think by the time Jerry became CEO, I don't think it was, and you could see, look at the succession of CEOs after that. They all followed, despite saying they were doing a new strategy. It was pretty much the same strategy.
And Terry Semel, big mistake or nothing he could do?
I love Terry. Terry's a great guy. I don't want to, I'm not here to talk, you know.
No, it's just interesting because we see this in the music business, both famously with Andy Lack, now is back in the news business, came in and he really didn't understand the business. So we look at Terry Semel, who came from entertainment. Was he a fish out of water and really did not understand the technology business?
You know, I think there are probably people who are in a better position to answer that than me, to be honest with you. I didn't work that closely with Terry. I was off kind of doing my own thing in mobile, and he was
okay,
more focused
so
on the
tech. You wake up one day on a plane and say, I'm done at Yahoo?
It was coming for a while longer than that. You know, the company got bigger, and I don't know, just I kind of had an itch to go do something smaller. I think politics had changed in the company. It wasn't as fun as it once was. I kind of waited around, you know, you guys might remember Microsoft bid for Yahoo and a hostile takeover thing, and then Carl Icahn got involved, and that was a moment where you're like, I never thought I'd work for a company that Carl Icahn was making a bid for. It was time. It was time to do something different.
And the next step was?
So I went to a couple different startups. I really wanted to be CEO of something. And so I went to one company that I stayed in the mobile world, and it was a social networking app that had taken off. I was on feature phones. And It was called MiG33. And, you know, Android was almost non-existent at this point. This is now fall of 2008. It had taken off in places like Indonesia, India, Malaysia, a little bit in South Africa. And we ended up moving the company to Singapore because it was just, I didn't move with it.
What was the motivation?
It was impossible to run a company in that part of the world from California. It was just happenstance that the customers were there. The ARPUs out of those customers don't support California engineering costs. You're not close. You know, the thing is, none of our engineers or product people really used the product because it was a social networking thing. They're all on Facebook. And so they don't know their own product in a way that you can only know. In the internet, if you're not close to your customer, you're just not going to have a successful service. So it started to languish in terms of product innovation. So we decided to move it there. It ultimately, that company ultimately got listed on the Australian Exchange and then got bought out. And I'm not sure what's going on with it. I haven't kept up with it. And then I went to another company called Looped, which was one of the original apps around social location sharing and social location sharing, which ultimately got sold.
And the name of that was?
That was Looped. LOOPT.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. It ultimately got sold. I think the company had its moment in the sun, like internet companies do or consumer companies do. And they either kind of continue on that trajectory or they flatline. It started to flatline and it got bought out primarily for the tech talent that was in the company. And that's when Amazon called.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boob, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. This week, I'm speaking with Steve Boob. Over the last couple of months, I've interviewed the lead singer of Free and Bad Company, Paul Rogers, and social media expert at UTA, Kendall Ostrow. We try to provide a balance of entertaining and informative content for you here on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Be the first to hear next week's episode by subscribing to the podcast on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or your podcast app of choice. While you're there, please rate and review the podcast. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Steve Boob. Amazon called you, and yeah. What was the gig they were looking for you to fill?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, at least for me. They called and said, well, we're starting to invest heavily in digital media. This is 2011, and so the Prime Video service had only recently launched, and the Amazon Cloud Locker had just recently launched. And I remember reading about that because it caused a bit of kerfuffle in the industry because it was unlicensed. And I think that's why it made all the tech news. And they said, look, we're investing in digital media. We're looking for some executives to come build this out. And I said, well, you can see from my LinkedIn that I don't have any background in music or video. And the answer was, yes, that's probably not a bad thing. And their view was, you know, at a company like Amazon, you know, your traditional music industry exec, the hit rate was going to be lower for them to succeed at a company like Amazon. They really wanted someone more with a more tech background because the roles involved running engineering teams and product teams, and someone maybe came from a more data-driven background.
And so what was your were your responsibilities when you finally got the gig and went into the building?
Well, before I joined, I thought it was going to be all of music, including physical music. But I had dinner with my boss a month before I joined. I said, hey, I just want to let you know there's a reorg coming. The company's going to just split the physical and digital businesses all together, not just in music, but across the board. Just realize how fundamentally different they are, other than the fact that your partners are the same. But from a running a business perspective, they're just totally different. And he said, I doubt if you're too upset about not having to run the physical business. And I was like, you know, I'm just excited to be joining Amazon, whatever, it's fine. So when I joined, my role and continues to be to run Amazon's digital music business from soup to nuts. And that's the way the company organizes itself. It really has true general managers that have product and engineering and marketing and finance and business development and, you know, licensing, label relations, all that stuff rolls up into a single leader. And that's the way the company has always organized itself.
Now, there's a point where you go to Bezos with a pitch. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, I mean, Amazon had been in digital music since 2007. It launched the MP3 store. It was the first guy to launch with DRM, without DRM, I should say. But, you know, honestly, had modest success in the download business. And it was clearly a segment that was being fairly well dominated by one player, given the device ecosystem. We knew we needed to get into streaming, and the pitch was what I basically just, you know, basically kind of described with Prime Music, which is, Jeff, we should get into streaming. That's where our customers are going. And, you know, at Amazon, everything is customer first, customer first, customer first. So we saw what our customers were doing. And, you know, we had seen that the Prime Video service, we're in early 2013, the time frame that I'm talking about. And we could tell that Prime Video seemed to be getting traction. And the company was starting to invest more in the Prime Video service and was really starting to put its weight behind it. And, you know, Jeff, we had talked to him before, like, how do you consider, what do you think about adding things to Prime? And, you know, obviously the things you want to add to a service like Prime are things that have broad appeal. And what has broader appeal than music? Really nothing. And people had been speculating for a long time, when is Amazon going to add a music service to Prime? When, you know, it's got to be coming soon. And so we do what you do at Amazon. We spent several months. We have a certain process that we follow there, which is different than in other companies. And what we do is we write a press release, a one-page press release of explain to the consumer what you're about to launch. And you polish that, because if you can't do that, then you don't know what, you know, you haven't figured out what it is you want to do. And then behind that one-page press release, we call this document a PR FAQ. There's an FAQ, frequently asked questions section after that. And you write your own questions and answers. And then we call a meeting. And there's then financial support and exhibits and all that kind of stuff. And we call a meeting, and we called a meeting with Jeff, with our CFO at the time, a guy named Tom Skutak, who is not our, Brian Olsavsky is the current CFO, and several other, you know, senior leaders at the company. Spent 90 minutes, first 30 minutes of that meeting, you know, it was a bunch of middle-aged people with reading glasses sitting around staring at this document and reading it, because we don't PowerPoint at Amazon. We don't believe in it, except if I were giving you a speech, I would PowerPoint, but...
Then what's the difference? Why no PowerPoint inside the building and PowerPoint outside the building?
Well, because if the purpose of a meeting is to make a decision, PowerPoint's not a good meeting. It's a good way to tell a story and present something. But if you want to make a decision, you know, there's two things. One, in PowerPoint, it's really easy to have bullet points and to BS your way through things, right? It's like... Try to do that when you have to write complete sentences in a paragraph form and make it a narrative that stretches over six pages. You find yourself testing your own thinking is refined and refined and refined until it all hangs. The other part is when you give a presentation, if we were to try to decide something in this room, all of us together, some of you would know what I'm talking about before I even got up here, maybe more than I do. And then some of you would know nothing about the topic. And I'd be trying to give a presentation, hands would be going up, and you'd be asking questions about slide 27, even though I'm slide 7, and there's someone who's still trying to figure out slide 3. And you have a complete mismatch of information, so the conversation is not even-handed. And so what happens, the way we do things, you walk into the room, you hand out this, you make whatever, 10 copies, 20 copies, however many people are in the meeting, and we all then read. And the idea is, when we're done reading, some people will still have more information than others, but everyone will have the same baseline. And that baseline should be sufficient to make the decision that we're asking you to make. And so we'll all sit there and read it ahead of time. And I heard Jeff explain, why don't you read it in advance? I think there's two answers. One is no one has time. And the other is, and this, I laughed when I heard this because I was just listening to this in some speech he gave recently. He said, because everyone in the room is really smart, and they won't read it ahead of time, but then they'll BS their way through it and act like they did. And so this way you're forced to sit there and, you know, what else are you going to do? You know, there's this thing in front of you. So we spent 90 minutes. And
so once again, how long do people spend reading?
30 minutes.
Okay, but I just remember, you know, like being in school, you're always uptight. Are you fast? Are you slow? Are you going to be ahead of this person? It's almost like you feel a pressure.
You know, we're all friends and colleagues, so... you know, you wait. If it's your meeting, you kind of look around and you say, okay, it looks like, does anyone need more time? Or sometimes you'll say, look, we're going to read for 30 minutes and then we're going to talk after that. And, yeah, if you haven't read every word, it's not the end of the world. And then we talked about it for the next, I think it was a 90-minute meeting probably, and they asked a bunch of questions, talked about the numbers, et cetera, the product primarily, and, okay, let's do this. And, you know, that's, for me, pretty remarkable. I've worked in a number of places, and we had prepared, so it's not like we didn't come in half prepared, because that could have been go back and think about this and that and the other thing. But it was, we thought about it, thought it through, and had a decision taken in that meeting, and
so,
go launch it.
You know, everybody, at this point, you talk about a CEO with vision. At this point, with the death of Steve Jobs and the retirement of other people, the two people people focus on are Elon Musk and Bezos. So of all the CEOs you've dealt with, what does Jeff do differently?
I think he's very demanding, has very great clarity. And I think he talks the talk and walks the walk. So we've set out broad principles that we manage by at the company. He reiterates them. Explains them when he feels necessary. But mostly what I think he does that's great is he lets his leaders lead.
So if we were to get him on the phone right now and we were to talk about some details of Amazon Music, would he be familiar with those?
Yeah.
So he dives down into all the product verticals. So from the time you decided that you wanted to do this till you got a yes, how long was that?
Well, the yes was in that meeting. I don't know when we started.
No, I'm talking about from the time you said.
A few months. Don't know exactly.
And then you built everything from scratch. You didn't buy anything.
No, we haven't bought anything in music.
Well, that's interesting because everybody else is buying services.
Yeah.
You know, Apple bought Beats and other things to give it a leg up. Why do you decide with certain players in the marketplace that you're going to start from scratch?
There's lots of reasons. I mean, you know. Well, now we already have an infrastructure. So if I were buying something, it would be to buy subscribers.
Right.
I haven't come across, other than the biggest of the big, I haven't come across companies that can really accelerate our growth. We're doing just fine. Thank you. But in the earlier days, look, you can spend as much time trying to integrate their systems into the Amazon systems as it'll take you just to build it from scratch. And we did look at companies, and either the prices didn't make sense for what you were getting, or we didn't think the technology was all that great. That happens a lot. a lot of startups, you know, the biggest thing when you buy them, and I saw this at Yahoo all the time, because Yahoo operated at an incredible scale. And we bought a lot of companies in the late 90s. And the first thing you'd end up doing half the time is having to rebuild half the technology because it just couldn't scale. It's a lot different now because everyone runs on Amazon Web Services, so things scale seamlessly. But back then, that didn't exist. Some of these companies that are trying to sell themselves, maybe their technology is just based on an older technology stack. You know, they've been around for a few years, and they're using older technologies that, yeah, we're going to have to replace that. So what's the point?
And do you hire outside people to build it, or you have inside engineers at Amazon who build your music service?
Yeah, no, we build it in-house, and we've staffed up our team, but we don't use third parties. It's all internal.
Okay, so from the time you launch it, at what point is the Echo introduced?
5 months later, it turns out. So we launched in June 2014, Prime Music in the United States. The Echo launched on a beta invitation-only basis in November, or late October, early to mid-November, somewhere in that range, 2014.
And at what point did you feel this is the future?
Probably March 2015.
And what was the light bulb moment?
There were a couple light bulb moments. The first was just being consumers ourselves and being in the music game. So, you know, we had Echoes, some of us on the music team when no one knew this product even existed, but it's a beta product, it's an alpha product. And, you know, it works, and some days it works, some days it doesn't work, like any product that's in development. So you don't really get that full customer experience. The magic wasn't happening just yet. But then, you know, once it started shipping, then of course we all had them. And what I tell everybody is, because we've given a lot of people Echoes, of, you know, when we visit the labels, like, here, you should have one of this. And what I tell people is, if I come back and it's sitting in your office, I'm taking it back with me. Put it in your house, because it's not meant to be in your office. You can put one there, it's great, but if you want to understand the magic of the voice interface, and you have to have it in your home. It has to be in an area where you're going about your business, doing other things. It's in a high traffic area. It's in a communal area. And so we started using them in our homes, right? And so when it was in beta, we weren't really using them in our homes because you never know who's going to pop into your house, that kind of thing. So part of it is we were just consumers, and we started to understand the possibility. The other part was we started to look at data, and we could see, of the very few people that had gotten Echoes in the very early part of 2015, because they were in very short supply, just how much they were being used for music, and the different ways in which they're being used for music, the ways that people were asking to have Alexa play music for them, in many cases was very different than you would expect them to do if they had a visual app like an iPhone or an Android app. And that's when we kind of realized, put all that stuff together, like this is profound. And I've been around the block a couple times, and I've seen these platform shifts happen, and it was, okay, I remember the shift from, you know, button to touch interface and the impact that had fundamentally in mobile. And we just started to, you know, extrapolate out and dream a little bit and say, you know, is voice that level of a shift in platform, in the way people compute, interact with computers? And, you know, we thought it would be, and particularly we thought it would be for interacting with digital media, because we just, once you use it, you're like, this is just easier. It's so much better. It's, you know, it's so much less friction. You know, the first time, I'm sure all of you guys have used voice controls at some point, but man, the first time you show someone of any technical background, from my mother-in-law to an engineer, she's not an engineer, by the way, so I mean, like, she's got the less technical background of those two people, and you just say, Alexa, play and name a song, and it comes out. That's just magic. And the first time, now it's, the best innovations seem commonplace 3-4 years later. And like, well, of course, but that was not an of course a few years ago. And it truly, I remember showing it to, you know, record label executives, their eyes popped out, you know, and that magic, once we understood that magic, we realized this is just the way that you can interact with digital media. It's just better.
And do you think at this point the music industry is up to speed on what a huge breakthrough this is?
At this point now in 2018? Yes. Oh, yeah, totally.
You think people understand that? Because they have been historically late to everything, whether it be file trading, digital download, streaming.
Yeah, I got to say, you're right. And I have to, I'm not getting paid to say this, but I have to take my hat off to the labels, because we went to go talk about Amazon Music Unlimited in the very beginning of 2016. So this is after the very first Echo Christmas, but it was a smallish Echo Christmas. The device was a year old. And, we went to go pitch them on the deals, and we came with suitcases full of Echoes to hand out to everybody. And I gave my little speech. But what we found was that to a person, they had all bought them already. They had gifted them to friends over the holiday. They all were super up to date on it and understood the opportunity. So, very collaborative conversations from the get-go. It wasn't, I think, what maybe conversations were in previous generations. And I think that's a lot of streaming obviously was advancing, and the label saw that this was going to be their business going forward. And then they saw this device, and I think they used it as consumers, and they understood the power of it.
Well, I just know it's one of the products that was sold by word of mouth. First of all, there was theoretically limited availability, but I was talking...
Not theoretically. I'll tell you, I had one, but I ordered it in November when it first came out, November 2014. It showed up on my doorstep in May the following year. So it really was limited. It started to be, they ramped up production, that year at some point.
Well, Gary Delabate, I was talking to him, he's really a producer of the Howard Stern Show. And there was such zeal, I had to get one. And it was sort of like, first of all, we're in more of a software era than a hardware era. But his excitement made me feel that I wanted to get one. Same thing in terms of Amazon Music Unlimited. Doesn't seem like there's a lot of advertising outside of the Amazon ecosystem. But talk about the little triggers you have in your system to try to get people to upgrade.
Yeah, so... one of the things we worked on for the launch was we wanted to make sure the subscription process was as simple as possible. We obviously, like one of our competitors, have lots of customers' credit card accounts. People buy stuff from Amazon. That's what they do. We have a commerce-based relationship with them. And, we wanted to make sure they could just talk to Alexa to subscribe. So you can do that. And... we're pretty confident that that's the most frictionless, the least amount of friction in any subscription that I've ever seen. And so one of the things we do, if you were to ask for a track, and say you're a Prime member, if you were to ask for a track that's not in Prime Music, so it's not part of those 2 million odd songs, you would hear Alexa say something like, that song is not in Prime Music, it's available in Amazon Music Unlimited, along with tens of millions of other songs or something like that. Free trial for 30 days. After that, it's $3.99 a month. Shall I start your free trial? Yes. That's all you have to say. And the music will start playing. I don't know if it gets any easier than that. And so we do that, and that's very effective, because you're... It's always more effective to get someone to upgrade to something when they're in the moment than they're already so far down that funnel in consideration that it doesn't take a lot to get them over the last hurdle. If you're having to spend, $250 million creating a brand for yourself, that's just creating awareness. So once they're on the Echo device, we do that. We do things if you have multiple Echoes in your home and say you're listening in one room and your kid's listening and wants to listen. Well, let's put it the other way. Your kid's listening in one room and then you're in the other room and you try to listen and Alexa will say, because you're limited to one stream at a time and all these music services. That's a condition of the labels. She'd say something like, music is playing on the other device. But if you upgrade to the family plan, you can have up to 6 concurrent streams. And it turns out that's pretty effective. you know, because if you really want to listen to music and you maybe didn't even know the family plan existed, right? And now he's like, oh, cool. Well, we have four Echoes. I got three kids. Great, let's do it.
And also, assuming someone's not asking for something that's not in the 2 million catalog, you do have periodic ads, shall we say them, to upgrade.
Well, we communicate with our customers, but Alexa doesn't run ads.
Right.
So,
but you're communicating saying, hey, this opportunity is here.
Through normal like email and push messaging channels, but not, there's, you know, Alexa's personality is it's very carefully guarded. She's not going to be, you know, she's not meant there to hawk products, you know, and she's not meant to be too salesy. So if you're just, if you're listening to a playlist, you're not going to get interrupted in the middle, in between songs and say, hey, by the way, there's this thing called Amazon Music Unlimited. There's no advertising on Echo. And we don't advertise like that either. It's, okay, it's so just contextual.
There's no pushing of the unlimited service on Alexa unless you ask for something that is not there.
Yeah, unless you're really in the moment of wanting music and we think we can improve your experience.
Okay, so in the world today of selling music, not literally, but marketing music, playlists are thought to be king. How does someone enter the Amazon ecosystem and get their songs heard?
Well, first of all, we have a team of programmers who are out looking for music and deciding themselves.
How many people are there?
Tens.
Okay.
And they're out and, you know, they're in different cities and assigned to different genres. You know, our country programmers are in Nashville, not a big surprise. And they're out doing what those guys do. They go out to listen to new bands play and new artists, and they listen for music. We obviously meet with the record labels. We meet with artist management, and we get played a lot of music. You know, it's ultimately an editorial decision. You know, what is it that we want to play? And, you know, we'll promote music when it comes. If there's an artist that we want to get behind, we work with the label to promote them. But ultimately, the decision of what and where to put something in a playlist comes down to the editorial team.
Okay, but if you're a manager, there is someone you can meet with?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and then you subsequently look at the data and therefore massage what gets played and what's not, what gets added and gets dropped from playlists based on the number of streams?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. And Amazon has seen somewhat of as a black hole. You know, Spotify is now public. They're releasing a lot of information. First and foremost, if I am an artist on Amazon, do you have a dashboard where I can see all my data?
Not at the current time. So we will. We eventually will. We just don't have it yet. We've been more focused on, you know, getting big enough that artists would want to come look at a dashboard on Amazon.
Okay, and then you have Apple, as I say, trumpeting how many urban streams they have, and we don't really know what's going on at Amazon. First question is, what is going on? And second, is there a way for us to find out on a regular basis?
I can't come here every day, sorry. What is going on? Lots is going on. But yeah, as a company, we tend to be more reticent to share data. It's just across the board. I value my job, so I try not to share too much. Ultimately, we will create an avenue for artists to see what's going on in real time. I mean, we obviously give reports to all the labels, and so the labels know what's going on in our service. But we don't make it as public as some of the other services. We also don't just generally beat our chest as much and try to, like, you know, talk about how many streams X artist did in the first weekend. It's just sort of not, it's just not really what we do as much.
We'll pause here for a brief moment and get right back to VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom. As most of you know, I'm a writer, and you can read my work at leftsets.com. In addition to reading my commentary on music, tech, and the world at large, you'll be the first to find out when we've published a new podcast. Go to leftsets.com and sign up for the newsletter. Now, more with VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. Reason, don't know What can you say? We talked about this a little earlier, and I'll use the word counterintuitive. What do we learn about what's happening on the Amazon service as opposed to its competitors?
I'm not even sure how to answer that. Such a broad question. Are you specifically looking
at? Are there different genres that are emphasized?
Yeah, you'll see different. Like I said, you'll see different genres. Look at our charts. They look very different. They look wildly different.
Well, would you say, therefore, that Amazon is reaching a different segment of the public or a more representative segment of the public?
That's a tough question to answer. I think it's a broader cross-section of the public. If your goal is to be, you know, a service for the most popular music right now in terms of streaming, you know, then you're going to be focused on nothing but hip-hop. I think it's a more representative cross-section of the country. And, you know, also I can tell you, you know, if you think about Amazon and our customer base, at our core, we sell people things. And therefore, our average customer buys things, therefore has disposable income and a credit card. So therefore, our customer base skews a bit older than the other guys. That doesn't mean it's old. It just means it starts more at a young adult and goes up from there, right? We don't have a free tier. So,
well, essentially you do, because it's baked into the now $119 Amazon Prime.
But you have to be a Prime member, and that's not an unlimited number of people.
Well, Bezos said, you know, there are 100 million Prime members.
That's a global number, yeah.
Right. Well, how many countries is Amazon Music in at this point?
Around 40. Around 40.
And you can get unlimited in all those 40 countries?
All but one, but that's coming, yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So, but essentially, it feels free to the consumer.
Unless if you have Prime.
Yep. If you have Prime.
Yep.
Okay. Which, of course, the original sales pitch is the two-day delivery, which I think with its original price of $79 was, you know, now that it's going up, you're looking at the add-ons. Okay. So what do you see right now, despite protestations of the minor players, is essentially a three-horse race between Apple, Spotify, and Amazon. Mm-hmm. What do you foresee in the future relative to the competition of those three?
I can speak to us. I mean, I like where we sit. You know, people, you know, we've grown pretty dramatically over the last 2 or 3 years. And to the point where, you know, it's quite clear that we're in that small group that you just mentioned. And, you know, we think we have a good trajectory and we have a pretty sound strategy. I think there's some secular trends that work in our favor, such as this platform shift to voice. So, you know, we see ourselves continuing to grow pretty rapidly. I know there's this narrative out there that everything in the internet is a winner take all. I don't really buy into that when it comes at least to digital media. I can see that where there are, you know, where network effects are the strongest thing in your business, like search or social networking, you know, arguably it's winner take all, even though there are many very successful social networking companies. I don't think that's the case in music. I do think it will be a small number, continue to be a small number of players globally. Is it those three? Is there going to be a fourth? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I know that we'll be up there.
If we look historically, you know, Google has 70% of search, Facebook. A lot of companies, a dominant player ends up with 60 to 70% of the marketplace because that's where all your friends are. There is a network effects thing. So I have all the services. I know how to share a song on Spotify. I don't know how to share a song on Apple, okay? And I think, and then, of course, if I share it with someone who's not a member, they can't listen. So I think these are important factors moving towards dominance of one of the services. You don't agree?
I don't agree that this is going to be a single, no. I wouldn't be doing this if we thought the game was over.
Well, I would think that, you know, from an outside observer, I don't mean this in a negative way. I would say that Amazon is the stealth player. with both deep pockets, big ecosystem, the prime, et cetera, they're the ones, they're frequently ignored. Like, talk to Daniel Glass, you know, 6 or 8 months ago, he says, you know, the sleeper is Amazon. And he talks about meeting with you and the other team. And the people who have been at the forefront.
Daniel's been saying that for way longer than 6 months. Okay.
But the people who have been in the forefront have been in serious whatever. They talk about Amazon being the sleeper.
Yeah.
But by the same
token. We like that, by the way. I like being the stealth one.
Okay, but as I say, it's hard to fathom. And one also would say that that's who we have to, you know, Spotify's a standalone product. I don't see it as a standalone company a long way down the line. What we look with Apple's, they have everybody's credit card, but who do they market to after? They don't have the free tier. And I always go back to the original example of AOL and MSN Network. Everyone thought MSN Network was going to kill AOL, and it did not. So the fact that you have a previous history does not necessarily mean success in the future. In addition, I don't believe there's a visionary leader at Apple, where there is a visionary leader at Amazon. Therefore, it's something I'm certainly paying attention to. But getting off of my little soapbox here, one of the things that amazed me when we met is that if I go on Spotify, which is the big kahuna this week, they break down the playlist down into certain things. But in reality, it's more granular on Amazon. You could say, like, play rock hits of 68. Can you tell the audience more about that?
Yeah, and that's actually what we saw customers doing, right? So, again, when we looked at the data of what are people doing on Alexa, the way I think about it is if you have a visual app, your iPhone app, your desktop app, your Android app, it's very powerful. It's also very constrained, right? There's the product manager decided how you're going to listen to music, whether you realize it or not. There's a search bar. There's a browse hierarchy of how you browse through music. And they fill the buckets of content for you. And not suggesting that's a bad thing. It is what it is, though. And that's how you're going to listen to music. When you have a headless, what we call a headless device, just nothing, there's no screen on an Echo, you're completely unconstrained. The way you want to interact with music is limited only by your own imagination. And lo and behold, when people are unconstrained, they act in an unconstrained way and they ask Alexa things. And, you know, what we saw was that the way I like to think about it is if you read the reviews of the Echo in the early days and still today, you'd see people saying things like, I love Alexa. Alexa's my friend. She's my best friend. Alexa's a member of my family. And so we tried to translate that into music and say, well, it makes sense that people are asking for things in a much more natural way than you would get in an app because they think of her as a friend. So they're going to talk to her like you're going to talk to her like you talk to your friend about music. And so people were asking for things. They're asking for songs because they only know a few words to the song. They can't remember the title of the artist. So they ask for by lyrics. They ask for the by mood. They ask, you know, play Pearl Jam from 1996. Play U2 from the 80s. Or play me some sad country music. Or I'm having a dinner party, Alexa. Can you play me some music, some jazz? And it's that kind of stuff where it's like music becoming part of what you do and responding to how you think about music. It's not always, and as great as playlists are, and I know they're the currency du jour and maybe for a long time to come, they're not the answer to every type of situation that you find yourself in wanting to listen to music. There's plenty of times you may not want to listen to a playlist. And so when you say, you know, play U2 from the 80s, we just make a playlist on the fly for you. We don't go deep into, we didn't have programmers creating, you know, all these things. We spent a lot of time cleaning up metadata. With all respect to my label friends here or who may listen to a recording of this, metadata sucks and it's a known problem in the industry. It tends to be incorrect or incomplete and certainly insufficient to respond to the kind of requests that people are asking for. Like, even if all the metadata from the labels were correct, they don't give us metadata that says this song is sad or this song is happy, this is upbeat, this is suitable for a dinner party, right? So that's metadata we had to go out and create. And we do that through a combination of brute force with humans and then deep learning.
So pretty much every song has metadata beyond writer, et cetera?
Yeah, and we've taken we've taken humans to take sample data sets and then use machine learning algorithms to learn, and you apply that against the greater catalog. Obviously, with a catalog of tens of millions of tracks, it would take humans years to go do this, but it doesn't take machines years. But then we have human curators that checking in on the mic. No, that one wasn't good, and you're constantly improving the model. And that enables us to do more fun things when people talk to Alexa and make it more natural. And believe me, we still got a long way to go. I mean, we've scratched the surface with what people want to do.
Okay, so when I ask like some rock music for 69, it creates a playlist on the fly.
Yeah,
there is no pre-existing plan.
There may be one, but if there's a pre-existing playlist that someone, you know, some curator created for something, we might pull from there. But we also know your listening habits, and maybe that's not the right one for you. So we'll create one on the fly, and then we'll personalize the sequence.
So generally speaking, if I'm talking to Alexa, I can talk year.
Yeah.
I can talk act.
Yeah. Era.
Genre.
Genre, mood.
What else? Mood.
Activity. What are you doing right now? You're going to go do yoga? You're going to have a dinner party? Studying?
So there's enough metadata that it will then just pull on that metadata to make a playlist on the fly. And I only know this from meeting with you previously. How is anybody supposed to know this? Or theoretically, they're developing a new way to interact with Alexa, and they're learning a new way of thinking about music.
Well, the whole idea is to make it natural. So like I said, most of what we're doing is stuff that people are already wanting to do. You know, we recently launched the ability for you to make playlists just using your voice on Alexa. And sure enough, I mean, people were trying to do it. It's a very natural thing to want to do in a music service. It's pretty complicated to do by voice, but it works really well. And lo and behold, people are already trying to do it. So instead of failing, it now succeeded. And so millions of playlists were created really, really quickly. There are certain things, yeah, that you know people have to learn as possible. But the idea is that, you know, by and large, people will stumble upon it when that's how they want to listen to music, when that's how they want to ask for something. I do think, you know, over time you'll see us and other services probably get better at helping customers understand what features are available. But most of the stuff we've launched to date has been, you know, that's just how people were already asking for it. People were saying things like, you know, play me the song that goes blah, 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 whatever the lyric is. And so we looked at that and was like, well, that people are failing because Alexa couldn't understand that. So we went out and created the ability to quickly look through lyrics databases and find that song, or, you know, play the new song, you know, by Mumford & Sons. Daniel's here, and hopefully they're going to have a new album sometime soon because we've been waiting for 3 years. I don't know, but I'm a big fan. And, you know, that's really easy to understand when it's the first single off the record. But when it's the third track off the record that Daniel's promoting, and that's one at radio right now, you know, which song should Alexa pull? They all have the same release date from the label. They all have the same release date of the record, of the album. So, you know, we worked with labels and ourselves and created this concept of radio impact date in our metadata for songs, so that when I say... Because the whole idea is I was listening to the radio, I heard the new song by Mumford & Sons, don't know the title, but it's the one that's on the radio that Daniel's promoting. Alexa, play the new song by Mumford & Sons. She's going to know which one to get. And so our focus has been primarily on things that people are doing already. And there's, like I said, there's a lot more to come. You know, the idea is it should be as natural as speaking to your best friend about music. If you and I were to go have a beer and just talk about music, not about the music business, but about artists and songs and stuff, we want Alexa to be able to hang with you and to be your guide and to be your friend and to be able to respond to that.
Well, some of this stealth stuff, I know that Randy arranged for us to get some Echo shows, and I had the default service as Spotify, which most people don't really know how to change. But once you got the Echo show and it could show the lyrics, I made the default service Amazon Music because I want to see the lyrics. We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. Hope you're enjoying listening to this episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. If you want to listen to sound bites from the interviews and see some of my guests, like Shirley Manson of Garbage or Paul Rogers of Bad Company and Free, check it out at TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, more of my chat with the head of Amazon Music, Steve Boone, on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. At this point, why don't we open it up to questions? I'm sure people have certain things. Jim has the mic. Once again, let's try to limit statements and make it more about questions for Steve here.
Hey, Steve. My question is, as you talk about the ecosystem between the Amazon Music streaming service and the Echo, yeah. do you view it more as a feature or a product?
We view Amazon Music as a service. Alexa itself is a platform that you can, it allows you to have other services available. So Amazon Music's available on iOS, on Android, on web, on TV platforms. So, we're building a self-standing music service. It just so happens our focus is to make it the best voice-forward music service in the world. We've brought voice controls into our mobile phone apps. So on iOS and Android, you can speak with Alexa. That's how we think we really rise above the crowd. But it's a service unto itself.
Yeah. Steven?
Peter, hey.
Shapiro. I didn't realize everybody's got a mic here.
That's okay. It's a cousin of kind of your core business, but I know Amazon was looking at ticketing. And ticketing in music. And maybe the only time Amazon had to pull back from entering a new vertical. And I don't know if you can give us color of the experience that Amazon had looking at going into music ticketing. And you had entered in Europe, I think, but now pretty publicly said, hey, we're going to pull back from that.
I wish I could shed insight. Yeah, we did have a small ticketing business in the UK. It really started in the West End with theater, dabbled with some concerts. I wasn't part of the decision process as to why the company pulled out, so I'm sorry, I can't really tell you much. But
one thing, the AEG, they had the Hyde Park shows. They were tied in with Amazon last summer, and they said that Amazon sold tickets that they couldn't sell. That you reached people that they didn't reach, that it was actually a benefit to it, as opposed to people thinking, well, Amazon's going to come in and take our business.
When Bob wants to replay his rock from 1969, does Amazon store that so that he could get the exact same playlist again, or will it fabricate a new one?
It's a great question. The next time, probably fabricate a new one, but when he's done listening, he could ask Alexa to save it as a playlist.
And then he would access it by saying, I want my June 22nd playlist.
When he creates one, she'll ask
She will ask how to store it.
You can assign a name to it, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, before we move on, how many people in the room have an Echo of some stripe?
Wow.
Okay, how many people have a Google Home?
I haven't.
How many people have a Home Pod? Who has the mic now, Jim?
Peter.
Okay.
Hey, how you doing? With everything going on with Cambridge Analytica and everything on Facebook, now you put a microphone in your house on all the time. Any thoughts on that?
Now, I want to comment on that because this is the type of thing that makes me fucking crazy.
Sorry, Bob. Okay?
In that I still at this late date get saying, I'm not going to have streaming. What if I'm out of cellular service? Now, for almost 10 years, they've had it so it syncs to your phone. You have to pay every month, but they have ownership. You can't get that message through. When it comes to the Echo devices, until they hear Alexa, the code word, the microphone is not on. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. So there's a small processor on the device that all it does is listen for Alexa. It's not connected to the cloud. When it hears Alexa, it opens up a connection to the cloud to capture what you say next, converts that into a WAV file, it's then interpreted into text, and it comes back down. So the reason there's a blue light so you know she's listening. If you ever want to make sure that nothing, like if one of the kids blurts out Alexa and you were on a super confidential conference call for work or something, there's a mute button which physically cuts the circuit of the microphones. Physically impossible for any sound to get back to Amazon. So privacy has been thought of in the very design of the device from day one, both in its construction of the device, as well as the visual cues to let you know when Alexa is listening. So it's something we take really, really seriously. I'm not the one in charge of that stuff, but it's something that I've heard described, and it's as I described to you. It's something, you know, Amazon, look, customer obsession and customer trust is at the center of our entire business. It is drilled into you from day one that you walk into the company. And we know that trust is something hard to earn and easy to lose. And it's not something that Amazon takes lightly. A lot of people have trusted us for years with purchasing a lot of important things in their lives. And you know, we're not doing anything to mess with that.
But having said that, the other half of his question is important. You have an incredible amount of data and knowledge of us. You know, as I say on Google, they can literally, they say you want to get someone to, you know, cough up something, just say you threaten them with release of their Google search history. But you literally have the purchase history. How do we know that you're not going to use that to our detriment or to brainwash us or to get us to do something we don't want to do?
I thought it was a music conference. and, you know, I'm happy to get our public policy people here, but I think we're the most trusted brand in America for a reason, and I kind of would leave it at that. You know, I'm not here really to talk about data.
Okay, as I say, I don't need to press it. I was expecting the answer, but I think the other half of the question, the non-technical question, is something that's in everybody's minds that certainly needs to be in the marketplace, if not a chilling effect on the abuse of data. Not that Amazon has a history there, but we want to put that in everybody's mind. Jake?
You know, Steve brought up something interesting, Steve, about the other Steve, about playlists. So Bob does a great playlist of rock from 69, and those of us really like Bob's taste, so we want to listen to Bob's playlist from 1969. Does Amazon currently, and I don't know, or will it allow third-party playlists to be made on the service where other people can go and listen to other curators besides your own playlists?
You mean playlist sharing?
Yeah, playlist sharing, or for that matter, I don't know if they're on here, but Majestic Casual is a great example of people that make playlists. They've been doing it for years. They started on YouTube. I go into my Sonos playlist search and I do Majestic Casual, and Deezer comes up with, you know, 100 playlists, and Apple Music comes up with 100 playlists, and Spotify the same thing. And they're just a playlist kind of brand.
Yeah, we have some of those.
Two questions. So first question is playlist sharing.
Yes, that's something we either do or are about to enable.
Okay. How will we enable that with voice?
We'll work through that.
Okay. The second thing is third-party playlists.
Yeah, we have some of those brands in our service. I don't know about Majestic Casual per se, but I know that we have some of the other ones in our service.
So one of the things when Troy Carter was here the other day, he said, you know, we concentrate mostly on our own playlists, and they're kind of pushing back against third-party playlists because they're afraid of graft, payola, to get on those bigger playlists. And I'm just trying to get your sort of take on the same thing.
Troy's a really smart guy, and I agree with him. And, you know, there's two angles to that. One is worrying about those types of things. But also you have to understand that we're a music service, and in a world where all of us have very similar music catalogs, we are going to differentiate ourselves through a variety of means, and one of those is our own curation. And so it's only natural that a music service would want to, you know, invest heavily in its own curation and make sure it's really great. But, and we know that we won't be doing payola and graft and all that other stuff, so I don't know what goes on in the other companies, so that is a concern.
Next person with the microphone.
Yeah, so actually, you just answered part of my question. The question was, my question is about Where do you think the responsibility lies for actual curation and promotion on the platform, specifically with regard to voice? How much of it is, or I know you don't like to share numbers, but how much of the traffic is organic, purely organic, I want to play this now, and how much of it is driven by your curation, and what direction is that moving, and how do you think about that?
Yeah, a substantial percentage of our listening is through curation. I think Troy might have mentioned some numbers the other day or recently, and you know, they seem in line with what we kind of see at Amazon Music and in that general range. What we see in voice is interesting behavior that you see. The same person will go from a very casual lean back, just play me some music or play a genre, play an artist, whatever, to then like go straight deep down into the catalog and want that specific track. And so just invert, but of course by just sheer volume, when you're in the lean back mode, you're going to hear more music than it's more tiring to say, play this track, play that track, play, you know, it takes you a long time to play. If that's 15 requests you have to come up with to listen to an hour of music. So we do see in voice people tending to listen to more hours, longer sessions, and a higher incidence of curated music, for sure.
Now, my girlfriend always says, I do these back exercises, and I have 30-second timers. And she says, well, you can set a series of continuous timers. I've yet to have been able to do that. But can I load Alexa up via voice? Can I say, play the Rolling Stones, then play Jesus Jones, then play Drake? Is there a way to do that?
You mean a cue? I mean, or
cue,
just,
would be
yeah,
a good way to put it.
Getting there, but not yet.
Okay, it's coming. And are there anybody else with raised hands here? Jim, over here.
Okay, you have a mic. In terms of statistics, how significant is music as a user case for the Echo in terms of versus other user activity, like asking for the weather or recipes or podcasts? And where do you see those statistics going in the future?
Yeah, so it's an extremely important use case among all things that people do on Alexa or on Echo. I like to remind my team that, you know, we sell a speaker that has an intelligent assistant in it who can do a lot of different things, but the main vehicle that we're delivering that intelligent assistant to the home is a speaker. And so not surprisingly, music is super important on a speaker because that's what people like to do on speakers. So it's one of the top at all times. How do I see that evolving over time? I think that will stay the case as long for devices where speakers are really the delivery vehicle for the intelligent assistant. I think if there are other devices that are less music-centric than a speaker, I think that percentage would be different. But in the smart speaker category, I expect music to continue to be up there no matter how many more skills are added to Alexa. And it's the thing that, you know, people use it not just a lot in terms of hours, but its frequency and repetition and coming back to it. The other skills like that, that, you know, weather, yes, smart home, something. If you control your lights, you know, you do turn them off and on fairly frequently, so you'll repeat that. But music has an incredible engagement level on the device.
Now, on the regular Amazon Prime, the more people listen, it costs you more money. Okay, so is there any talk at the company of dissuading people from listening because you literally have to pay for that?
No, I mean we know the value that it generates for Amazon. You know, we know that our Prime members who use Prime Music are better Prime members, and they renew their Prime memberships at a higher rate. They come out of their free trials of Amazon Prime at a higher rate than do people who don't use Prime Music. And, you know, we carefully watch that and understand the value that it's generating. And, you know, we're not trying to dissuade people from listening at all.
And yes,
So SiriusXM's done a great job of facilitating festival and concert live streaming. Red Bull TV's been doing it from a video perspective as well as others, although Red Bull just got out. Does Amazon have any intentions of getting into the live music streaming business via artists directly or festivals?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to talk about things here that we haven't done yet that we might do if we, you know, this isn't the forum where I'm going to disclose something like that. What I would say is we've been doing some live broadcasts lately with working with some of the labels and doing some really interesting promotions around new records by Justin Timberlake, by Elton John, just had these tribute albums, as well as by U2 in the winter, that are a combination of interviews and music, and it's really kind of like a live radio show. But in terms of whether we're going to do live concert streaming, this isn't the forum for me to talk about that.
Yeah, I have another question. You were talking about some of the metadata that you have to create on your own, and I've been recently reading articles about tags for your songs, and like, you know, I work with indie artists who work with TuneCore and CD Baby and places like that. Are you going to now go to some of these aggregators and potentially have a different metadata form for when you're submitting your music? You can say, this is a sad song, this is an upbeat dance song, and those kind of tags to help you guys with your service?
Yeah, we've been actually working with DDEX to try to update the DDEX standard to include more fields that are, you know, relevant for voice. And so that would be, you know, it'd be in the DDEX standard.
Okay.
Any other people with questions here? Okay. The thing about this is we've learned a lot about Amazon, and as I, even though I have the service, I'm still learning things, which speaks, you know, we the music people say, oh, market the hell out of it, but it's a stealth operation and something you definitely have to pay attention. And thanks so much, Steve, for coming and sharing that.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California, and produced by TuneIn. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom. I found it fascinating how Amazon Music uses data to its advantage. What part of the interview was interesting to you? Your feedback is always appreciated. You can email me at bob@lefsetz.com. Until next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.